Hey, Tina. Do we have any students here from Union Grove? No. Good morning. We want to welcome you all to our second case today. And a special welcome to the Union Grove High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar. We invite students to come and listen to an oral argument. We send them materials about the case that they will be hearing. And a justice is assigned to speak with the students at the end of the second oral argument. Everyone is invited, but no one is invited today because the students are not going to be able to wait and participate in this discussion. So is there anyone in the courtroom who would like a copy of the summary of the case that we have? If so, raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary. Okay, while that's being done, I shall introduce the court. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler, who would have talked to the students had the students stayed. With that introductory comment, I'll call 2013 AP 1205, First Weber Group, Inc. versus Synergy Real Estate Group, LLC. Arguing on behalf of First Weber Group is Kim Mormond. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Thank you for hearing this case today. Arbitration is a means of resolving disputes between parties. It's typically selected to avoid judicial proceedings. Arbitration is favored in Wisconsin, as in most jurisdictions. This pro-arbitration policy is backed by legislative enactments to support and enforce arbitration obligations, specifically Section 788.03 of the Wisconsin statutes, designed to compel arbitration. It is found that there is an agreement to arbitrate and a dispute between the parties that falls within the scope of that agreement and one party refuses. That is precisely the case we have today. This is also a case about the Realtor Association arbitration system. The Realtor Code of Ethics was created in 1913. Since its inception, the Realtor Code of Ethics has contained an obligation by its members to submit their disputes to arbitration if invoked. The Realtor arbitration system is recognized in the treatises as a model of such systems. The circuit court in the present case correctly found that there was an agreement to arbitrate and that the dispute between the parties fell within the scope of that agreement.
And before you go too far down, sure. I just have a question about the document that realtors are expected to sign. What is the actual caption of that document?
I have it in the thing here. It's long. It has agreement to arbitrate, et cetera.
Agreement to arbitrate and ethics are included, right, in the caption?
It may or may not have ethics in it, but because this is an arbitration form, but it is it's got a long title.
Okay. And in terms of, I read from the briefs, I take it that all realtors are expected to sign that if they want to be considered and be able to hold themselves out and be a member of the Realtors Association. Is that true?
Not exactly. Maybe I'm missing the point. There's when people join the Realtors Association, it's a voluntary association. They commit to following the realtor rules and regulations, which include adherence to the realtor code of ethics.
Okay.
That is...
So functionally, yes, if they
want to... Well, unless the document you're asking me about never would arrive, I mean, is a separate document created by the association simply for intake in the arbitration systems. It is not the agreement to arbitrate, despite its title. The commitment to arbitration in the Realtor Association arises from membership and agreement to abide by the rules and regulations, which include submitting to arbitration if invoked, and specifically to the Code of Ethics, which has an article which compels its members to submit to arbitration of their disputes if it's invoked.
And what I'm getting at is the consideration. And the consideration for signing the document, I suppose, from what you just told me, would be membership in that organization.
Yes. There, and I don't believe, I mean, there's a membership application which was referenced deep in this record, but it is not a contract at that point of consideration. It is, if you wish to be a member of the Realtors Association, you agree to abide by the Realtor Code of Ethics. One of the tenets of that Code of Ethics since its inception has been the duty to submit to arbitration within the association if it's invoked.
Okay. So if you want to be a member of the organization, this is what you have to sign.
Correct.
Thank
well,
you. What? Was there more?
No. The only thing I'm not sure about, Your Honor, Justice, because you referred to the document with a title. The document in the arbitration process.
And I'm using it as shorthand. I understand the steps you're taking. I just don't feel like repeating them. Okay. Thank you.
Counselor, why does there have to be a signing of this separate request and agreement to arbitrate or attend mediation proceedings? I can see why the person that wants it signs it. So that's the invocation of the obligation to arbitrate. In this case, the Synergy Group representation was okay. They signed the first one of these that went around, but they refused to sign the second one. And then there was no arbitration of the fees issue. Is that right?
As to the question of why they would sign it, it is because the there was some confusion in the Court of Appeals record about what there is. There's a Code of Ethics,
yep.
Realtor
okay.
Code of
Ethics. Okay.
Separate from that, the National Association of Realtors has created what's called the Realtor Code of Ethics and Arbitration Manual.
Okay.
In that manual, they have created various forms just for administrative purposes.
Right.
One of those is an intake form if you're requesting arbitration, and another one is what they expect the member, abiding by their obligations, to sign in response to once they've noticed arbitration. So once they found an arbitrable issue and noticed it, that form goes out, and that's supposed to be signed. The refusal to sign that form is, I guess, a breach of the rules, which the Realtor Association could take care of on its own if the person were still a member. And the refusal to attend arbitration means it doesn't occur at all. That makes sense.
So there was no arbitration on the second issue not because the form was not signed, but because Synergy refused to attend.
Correct.
Okay. That's what I was confused about. I thought that the signing, I couldn't understand if there was an agreement to arbitrate by being a member of Realtors, which I got, why they even had to sign and say, okay, I could see why you'd use the form administratively to begin the process by someone that wanted to submit an issue to arbitration. I just was confused about their not signing being the reason why there was no arbitration. It was that they didn't show up, and that's why there was no arbitration.
And only one, caveat to that. I wouldn't agree that there was no arbitration. There was no arbitration hearing. The hearing was not possible, but the arbitration process began, per our point of view.
My recollection is
your clients
were there at the date and time and place set for the arbitration hearing. The arbitrator was there, but then a phone call was received from the other party saying that we're not going to come. And so, therefore, the arbitrator said, well, if they're not going to be here, we can't have it.
I think that actually the counsel for the association called to ask, but yes, it was a phone call at that point.
But everyone else was there ready to go.
Everyone else was ready to go, yes.
Okay.
Counsel, the 180 days that the circuit court looked at, Is that contained in one of these documents?
The 180 days is a rule that's established in the arbitration manual, and the it's well, I can read out what it says, but it's whichever transaction, it's primarily aimed at transactional stuff, or the facts constituting the claim, whichever, or later. That is a rule of this within the association.
Is the real dispute here whether or not the violation of the 180 days should be a determination by the realtors or should be a determination by the court? Is that the nub of this case?
That is the nub of the case per the respondent. Per my point of view, I guess at this point, is that I believe the case law would separate. It gets a little, unfortunately, complicated overlapping terms, but substantive arbitrability in order to determine whether there is an agreement to arbitrate and a dispute that falls within that agreement. If that is the case, our reading of 788.03 and our reading of the case law and the treatises is that at that point, that gets given back to the arbitrators. Other questions about whether it's allegedly untimely or whether proper grievance procedure was sent or whether there's a proper notice are disputes that should have been handled by the, and left to the arbitrators.
Not to the court.
Not to the court. And the rationale behind that, in a very rough sense, is that if the people had complied with arbitration and gone to it, that meant there would be an agreement to arbitrate and a dispute subject to that agreement. At that point, all those decisions would normally be handled by the arbitrator. And I guess another way of looking at this is no one should be benefited by refusing to comply with the arbitration request just to get a shot at someone else, a court, determining what would be realtor rules or what would be associate or form-specific arbitration rules.
So does the court have to decide whether this 180-day provision, which I see at your appendix 91, and I found it in one other place too, but that's enough for the moment. The decision we have to make, whether this is a substantive provision or a procedural provision.
I believe the clarification and development of the law by this court at this point would be to draw that such a distinction, yes.
So, and it's your position, I'm assuming, or I guess I know from your brief, that it's procedural. Because yes. If it's procedural, it's determined by the arbitrator.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. How do I distinguish between procedural arbitrability and substantive arbitrability?
And that's a fair question there. Let me walk at it two different ways. One of them is just the idea. I think substantive arbitrability is saying, is there an agreement in the first place? And is there a dispute that falls within that agreement? If that is found, then the courts are supposed to compel arbitration. Decisions after that point are decisions which would be normally handled within the routine of the arbitration itself, and they are recognizing the case law and treatises as procedural items. If the courts were to take over them all, for example, what's being advocated here is that it's an erroneous argument, but it's being advocated by a respondent, that if one of these rules is not met per their unilateral allegation and not supported in the record, that arbitration cannot proceed, and therefore the court should order arbitration or not compel arbitration. There's no limit to how that would be applied. And I think in the treatises, the limit is substantive arbitrability only. Is there an agreement? Is there a dispute subject to that? At that point, the arbitrator should take over.
So let's just test that. Does anyone dispute that there's an agreement? Or, in other words, do the parties agree that there's an arbitration agreement?
Well, I believe the parties have agreed, and the circuit court found that there was an agreement based on membership.
Okay.
So the circuit court found both as a fact, and I had it later to quote, but they found that there is an agreement to arbitrate and that the dispute fell within the scope of that agreement.
And in the sense, and it's within the dispute was it's within the scope of the agreement because it's why? Is it because it specifically has a provision as to when the ethics complaint must be filed?
No, it's Article 17 of the Realtor Code of Ethics has contractual disputes and specified non-contractual disputes, which are specified in that article. This is a contract dispute.
So it's so specified in the agreement.
In the Code of Ethics, yes.
Okay, where is that?
Article 17 of the Code of Ethics is.
You could find it for me.
Excerpts from the Code of Ethics are in our appendix at page 83 to 85.
All right. 87, is that where we're talking about?
Yes. Starts at 83, 85, duty to arbitrate.
87.
Let's see. But it says, I want to know exactly what language you're reading.
I'm sorry. It does show up in here at page 80, our appendix 87.
And it's Article 17, right?
Correct.
That's the one I got red marked. In the event of contractual disputes or specific non-contractual disputes, as defined in 17.4, between the principals associated with different firms arising out of their relationship, the realtors shall submit the dispute to arbitration in accordance with the regulations of their board or boards rather than litigate the matter. The obligation to participate in arbitration contemplated by this article includes the obligation of realtors to cause their firms to arbitrate and be bound. The filing of litigation or refusal to withdraw from it is a refusal to arbitrate, right? I mean, that's what you're relying on. Is that it?
That is the core expression of the duty to arbitrate and has been since 1913. And on top of that, then, are rules that they've created that are now in the arbitration manual, which has an overlapping name, but is a different item.
But there really isn't a dispute among the parties, is there, that there was an agreement because you both belong to this association? Isn't the dispute whether you missed the time to take this up because it was the request to arbitrate was done after 180 days?
And that's I guess, a fair reading. I can't speak for them. But the circuit court found those two items, which we believe that at that point should have compelled arbitration. Because we believe it misread a case, it thought that all arbitrability issues had to be filtered through the court, which is not the law. And so, therefore, it decided the issue of timeliness and decided it incorrectly per our position.
Whose 180-day rule is it? Is it a statutory rule, or is it a rule that comes out of the arbitration manual?
Arbitration manual. It's a forum-specific issue or rule. It is one thing that got confused at the Court of Appeals. It is repeated on that intake form, but that intake form is not the agreement to arbitrate. It is simply
Okay. So if we agree with you that it's form-specific, that would make it procedural. Is there any way, if we find it's or conclude it's form-specific, as you say, that it could be substantive?
Not in this case. It simply does not arrive in a posture to have been that way. I will concede that it's possible someone had a contract that they bargained for that they said, absolutely no circumstances shall the arbitrators even look at this after 180 days, that arguably be substantive. That is not what we have here. And in that context, I would emphasize, I believe the resolution for the case law and development here would be the presumption that follows. It is presumed that substantive arbitrability issues, agreement to arbitrate, and dispute falling within that, are for the courts to determine whether anybody actually contracted or agreed to that. After that point, the treatises in the case law and the example of Howsam, which is followed at every level of the court system, is that after that, the procedural issues, there's a presumption that those are held by the arbitrators unless there is language removing that authority from them, which would be that example I think we just talked about. And what's important about that is I want to make one thing clear to the court. There was there was a seeming disconnect in this case about the agreement between the parties and the authorization for the Realtor Association to determine arbitrability, which is clearly documented in this file. On the submissions of both petitioners and respondent, it states at several points that the Realtors Association and the Grievance Committee has the authority to determine arbitrability. Arguably, if we had a different case, I could argue, and I would hope that this opinion wouldn't foreclose that, is that if that issue were posed, it wasn't here because the court agreed we had a dispute that fell into that. But arguably, the Realtors Association has sufficient language to actually determine that issue on a substantive level. But at a minimum, I believe for this court, is the way the issue was posed, with the circuit court finding it correctly as a fact that there's agreement to arbitrate and a dispute that falls within the scope, is that after that point there was a presumption that the arbitrators do this. So in other words, the search through the record for language should not be penalized against the petitioner because that wasn't a dispositive issue, and the court shouldn't get to dissect or parse that language. They presume that they get to authority, and in fact they did in this case. So in other words, it was taken somewhat by surprise, sort of like shadow boxing, because the respondent never, we didn't have a trial or oral argument at the circuit court level, and no oral argument, which may have been helpful at the court of appeals level, but respondent never questioned the authority of the association to determine arbitrability. His argument was simply, erroneously, that it ceased in 180 days. So in other words, from my perspective, we agreed on the core, and the Court of Appeals' opinion went a different direction and misconstrued the Realtor Association system to the point of actually threatening damage to it.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the court determined the matter was subject to arbitrability, but in the agreement that you both are on target with because of your relationship and being a member of Realtors, the arbitration panel could actually decide whether something was arbitrable because of the language in that agreement.
Well, the reason I say that is...
And we just never got to that here because the court made its own determination.
Yes. I mean, in other words, all I'm really trying to say is this record, when the Court of Appeals says we didn't point out the language, I'm trying to say, first of all, it's shadow boxing because it was never argued. The other part is it actually does contain the language, and not only is that language sufficient to arguably do a substantive issue, were that the issue. But since it's a contract dispute, there's no substantive dispute. It's squarely within the scope. So the authorization language that is there wouldn't have been needed to be pointed out to meet a burden of proof because the petitioner shouldn't have such a burden of proof.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Could I just ask for the record, are all people who sell real estate in the state required to be members of the association?
No.
Do you have any idea what the percentage of people who sell real estate?
I would be spitballing it, but I think it's over 90% are realtors. And the reason is not just sales pitch, but because of the benefits of the organization, access to their, you know, the MLS and whatnot. All of those are realtor association constructs paid for and developed by the associations in the state and nationwide. But to practice in the state, you only need a license. But to be a realtor, you have to join the association, and the code of ethics applies to those who join.
Suppose there was a dispute between a member of the association and someone who wasn't. Would any of this have an effect on those people?
Well, they could not be bound because they never said as members to be bound because they're not members, right? But what they could do is agree to be bound. In the arbitration manual, it has instances in there, for example, where a member of the public, like a client or a customer, could come to arbitration, and there's a way to hear that in front of the association, have to be bound. Also, realtors dealing with non-realtors can have an agreement that they'll abide by the same type of compensation determinations, like procuring cause and whatnot, that are held by the association, and they can agree to be bound, and those voluntarily can be heard in front of the association.
So the court's decision in this case will affect only those who have agreed to be bound by the agreements and the terms
of
membership.
Well, yes. I don't know what Debbie's brief said, but I think 13,000 members are a large number, the vast majority of realtors in the state. It would affect the realtor system itself because quite frankly, the Court of Appeals rendition of the realtors of the case law, I believe, but also the realtor system itself is itself damaging to that system and to reliance upon arbitration generally. If parties, for instance, were required to be able to argue all get go past if they're required to be taken past substantive arbitrability and argue all those other points, there would be no reliance upon arbitration, because it would essentially be an invitation of the court to decide all rule disputes, even if, and I would like to emphasize this here, even if that objection, for example, timeliness here, was never raised to the association. In the record here, the respondent just simply refused and sent an email saying, I believe this has been decided and settled. Well, that argument ultimately about res judicata was dismissed, rejected by the circuit court and never appealed. So that's gone. The only time timeliness was raised here is after it already refused to attend and after the association had already noticed and scheduled arbitration. I mean, that's why I also looked at the Baldwin case. If that were allowed, it'd be a way to game the system. In other words, they simply refused to arbitrate and then essentially be assured that they might get a court to redo the issue that they might fear or didn't want to do in front of the arbitrators, although that should have been required per case law.
Well, after the – I'm sorry, you've done Justice Ginsburg. After the Synergy Group did not appear, was there a decision by the arbitrator, default judgment or –
They don't do
judgment.
That.
Pardon me?
There was no decision. They sent a letter out from the executive council or whatever. What they're essentially saying is they don't feel they're in a position to do default judgments. And what if they had had – if the respondent scuttled his company and then quit the association, had he still been a member, they would have had internal means to make someone comply. It's a violation of our code of ethics not to. But since he was no longer a member, the only recourse they could do is document the failure to attend and then recommend legal action, which is what then resulted.
You know, the Court of Appeals had a very lengthy opinion here. It runs 24 pages of print. And on page 17, they conclude, thus, the question of the 180 days is an issue of substantive arbitrability reserved for judicial determination. And you disagree with that, right?
Yes.
So where did they go wrong?
Well, the circuit court found that there was an agreement to arbitrate based on membership. That fact was never appealed, and that fact shouldn't have been questioned. The Court of Appeals went a different direction. The Court of Appeals said, we don't find that there's an agreement to arbitrate. And this document that they signed as an intake form, whatever, it has 180 days written on it. So therefore, the Court of Appeals didn't acknowledge that membership, despite the fact that it was a fact in this case, despite the fact that it was even sent by treatises. The outside world recognizes that about the Realtor Association. It tried to treat that one single document as a source of the duty to arbitrate, which it is not. And having done so, it could go any way it wanted after that.
Is the heart of your opinion in paragraph 43 that says the question here is whether the agreement to arbitrate expired by its explicit terms. This is a question that goes to the existence of an agreement to arbitrate in the first place. Thus, it is an issue of substantive arbitrability reserved for judicial determination. I mean, is that the heart of this opinion?
Well, of this opinion?
Yes.
Erroneously so, yes. One could
In your position, if I understand it, is that there was an agreement to arbitrate. Whether it expired at 180 days and when the 180 days began and ended are subjects for arbitrability.
Yes. And
that's the fight in the nutshell.
That is the presumption that would help clarify the case law. And one more really quickly on that issue. There's another rule that I'll just paraphrase it quickly, but it's in Sorelli that the courts are not to deny a compelling arbitration in these systems unless it can be said with positive assurance that there's no interpretation of the agreement or even a substitute rule here to allow this to be arbitratable. I would argue that, and we didn't have time to get to it, but in the timing issue of what the trigger date to select, using the date of the final decision and order in the underlying case is completely reasonable, if not the only reasonable date. So there is, even throwing away all the stuff about presumption, substantive arbitrability, procedural, et cetera, it is certainly reasonable that that date be used, and it is the date we used. It's the date accepted by the association in noticing and scheduling arbitration. And if for no other reason, that rule would compel arbitration in this case.
Well, what I'm hearing you say is you want to win on the ground that the Circuit Court and Court of Appeals should never have reached the issue of arbitrability.
I believe that's
And then when they reached it, they did wrong, and that this has to go to arbitration.
That's
if you lose on that, then you're saying they decided the 180 days wrong. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And then if they decided it wrong, you win anyway.
Yes, and if someone believed, if I haven't done a good explanation or WRA hasn't done a good explanation or Wisconsin Realtors Association in their briefing, and if that all this stuff, if that's not convincing enough to show about what should be applied to presumptions and whatnot, the 180-day rule thing is something that should be decided by arbitrators. Per that system, if someone didn't agree, they could have but didn't appeal that at the initial determination, could have gone to the hearing and sought to argue the 180 days there. So the system provides for it to be challenged. And let's say they lost and got back to court on a confirmation or trying to vacate, it would be another chance to there's an arbitration decision. It doesn't mean it's just thrown to the wind. It means that those are the place where they're supposed to be decided first.
Thank you, Mr. Mormund. You have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you.
Council representing Synergy, James N. Graham.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Attorney James Graham representing the Synergy Group, the respondents in this case. Question is, does a party who enters into an arbitration agreement agree to indefinitely and infinitely subject all claims to arbitration throughout the rest of time, even when the claims already have been litigated in a court of law? The conclusion reached by the trial court in this case, as affirmed by the Court of Appeals, is no. My discussion today will focus on two of the reasons why that conclusion, I think, is inescapable. Number one, First Weber is a stop from pursuing its claim when it pursued the claim throughout litigation for over 9 months through the trial court, through motions for reconsideration, arguments, affidavits, briefs, and so forth.
I'm sorry, but, you know, First Weber had several claims. One for the $5,000. Two for the fees. What claim are you talking about?
I'm talking about the fee claim only.
That's what I thought you were. Okay. So on the fee claim, they had a right to go to the court, right, because they had an arbitration decision giving them the fee, and you didn't pay it, so they can confirm it in court, no?
No. Okay. Let me back up then and go over the facts just briefly, what happened
historically
here. There was an arbitration agreement, which the court has seen. Both parties agreed to arbitrate commission dispute. The award from the arbitrator was, in our opinion, we read it one way, First Weber read it another, so they filed an action to confirm the arbitrator's award. This was of the commission amount.
Right.
They also included in their demand that the award not only be confirmed pursuant to the statute, but they also asked that there be a finding of joint and several liability, and they also demanded their attorney's fees. The issue of the commission and the joint and several liability issues were all resolved by March of 2011. There was a final decision by the trial court on everything in the case except the trial court then decided to undertake the question of, was First Weber entitled to collect its costs and attorney's fees? Attorney Mormon submitted briefs. He submitted counterbriefs. There was argument. The court rendered a decision. No.
Was that March 16th of 2011?
Yes.
But there was no appealable order entered at that time, correct?
I don't recall if that... let me think. I don't recall that there was an appealable order entered because immediately thereafter there was a motion for reconsideration filed.
What are the attorney fees for?
Excellent question, Justice Prosser. The ostensibly, the claim for attorney's fees is for the attorney's fees incurred in the confirmation and enforcement of an arbitration award. And the proof submitted by First Weber purport to be for that purpose. Well, if you actually look at the affidavits, much of the claim is for fees incurred in arguing about whether they were entitled to fees. But the ostensible claim for fees is for fees incurred in the enforcement and confirmation of the award. That was what they pled they were entitled to and so forth.
The ordinary American rule is you don't get your attorney fees unless there's something special, right? A statute. We don't have a statute here, right? So the basis for getting actual attorney fees or actual reasonable attorney fees comes from where? Doesn't it come from the arbitration agreement or the code of professional responsibility, professional ethics here? I mean,
Justice Abramson, we don't believe that they're entitled to their attorney's fees for a completely separate reason. But
I understand
the claim that they've asserted is yes.
It's that it's under the arbitration agreement, right? That the arbitration agreement says that if you go to court, you get attorney fees, huh? What does the arbitration agreement say?
It says that in the event that if you have my supplemental appendix available and review page sub F 4.
Okay.
This was the actual arbitration agreement signed by my side anyway. Paragraph 8, second part, says, in the event I do not comply with the arbitration award, I agree to pay the party obtaining such confirmation the costs and reasonable attorney's fees incurred in obtaining such confirmation and enforcement.
It's not limited to 180 days, is it?
No, that particular provision doesn't have its own limitation. All disputes are limited to 180 days under the rules of the realtors as are identified in this agreement to arbitrate.
Well, are they really limited to 180 days? I'm looking at appendix page 91, which is the filing ethics complaint and arbitration request, Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin heading. And that's where you get the 180 days, I think. I'm looking at the petitioner's appendix, so maybe that might be of assistance telling you that when I say page 91. It brings a smile to my face to read the provision regarding ethics complaints on appendix 91. Must be filed within 180 days, etc. Except the very ending of that seems to have a discovery provision. And we have a case this afternoon that deals with discovery rule. The ending of that provision with regard to the 180 days, and I'm not sure about this, but it reads, I'm sure it reads, how to interpret it may be another thing. or within 180 days after the facts constituting the arbitral matter could have been known in the exercise of reasonable diligence. So, when did the 180 days start here? When did the 180 days start? What should we pin it on?
Well, first of all, where does the 180 days come from is not solely this document that you're pointing to. So there are other, and in fact, it's stated that the request to arbitrate form itself says it must be filed within 180 days. But from when is Your Honor's question.
Mm-hmm.
When the facts constituting the, basically when you know there's a dispute, that's the answer. So when did First Weber know there was a dispute about whether it was entitled to collect its attorney's fees?
Is that the date? Or is it the date the court made the decision on the issue? Or is it the date that the court denied reconsideration? Or is it the date, and I'm assuming there's an order in the record, and I haven't reviewed that, but or is it the date of the order? When does, as we would say, when does the 180 days begin, or when does the time limit accrue?
Justice Bradley, our position is the date is when the dispute was known, which is when they made a claim and it was disputed. That's also the decision the trial court found. That's also the conceded date in their own submissions to the trial court. First Weber acknowledged that its claim was ripe as of March of 2011. States it plain, our complaint, our claim is ripe, presently ripe. They were asking the court to address it then.
Mr. Graham, even if we accept that, and even if you're right, why isn't it a subject for arbitration? Why should we be getting into the substance when there appears to be an arbitration agreement here?
Well, again, if I may, there's two reasons. One is they're stopped from first going through the litigation process, losing, and then bringing it up again.
I didn't mean to upset you.
Yeah, I don't mean to throw things around, but...
Take your time.
They are stopped from pursuing this throughout the litigation and then raising it again. They also...
But they had... I mean, if they get a call on the day of arbitration saying, hey, the other side isn't going to show up, what are they supposed to do? I mean, what would you do?
It was too late. There was a dispute...
Who made the determination it was too late?
There was a dispute in March. The court directed them that the proper process in March of 2011 was to take the matter through arbitration. We directed them that that was the proper process. They elected to continue to litigate it. Only later did they submit a undated request to arbitrate that contains no indication of what the supposed date of discovery of this problem was, and said, you've got to come arbitrate this.
Well, isn't that a question of procedural arbitration? And isn't that specifically covered under the arbitration agreement?
Question of whether they're stopped from bringing a claim again?
Yes.
No, that's a legal question.
Well, I guess more to the point, my question is, shouldn't the whole issue have been resolved by arbitration? And you point to, well, they went through the circuit court. It seems to me if you object now to running to circuit court for relief, that that the remedy would be to say, no, we have an agreement for arbitration. But then we come back full circle to the fact that apparently, and you're not disputing this, so I take this true and it's in the briefs, your client elected not to appear at the arbitration that had been set.
My client never agreed to arbitrate a claim that was older than 180 days.
Counsel, can you help me out with this a little bit? There's a dispute. These two people want the fees. I'm not talking the attorney's fees and costs. I'm talking about the commission, right?
Correct.
So they go to arbitration. Arbitration goes against your client. So there's, let's just say $5,000 your client owes to the other person, right? Your client has X amount of days, 15 or something, to pay that, right?
Correct.
Doesn't do so, right? So then they bring a confirmation in court action. I'm just kind of looking back at when I had these kinds of things as a topic. The confirmation action, the judge is deciding, okay, do I vacate this, confirm it, modify it? What do I do with this confirmation work? But you're pretty limited. It's not like you just have a whole new trial or rethink the issues or decide whether the arbitrator was right or wrong or whatever. That's just, it's not a particularly overly complex hearing. You sort of butt out and defer to the fact that the arbitration occurred and a result was reached, so long as it's not completely, totally, and utterly wrong, right?
Correct.
So your client is already behind with respect to, okay, I owe the $5,000. I'm just using the round figures. Then in that circuit court proceeding for the first time, the costs and fees, attorney's fees issue is raised because in confirmation you can get the attorney's fees, right?
Correct.
Is your position that it should have never been raised in the circuit court in the first instance, and as soon as they got the award confirmed by the circuit court, they should have gone back and filed for arbitration on the attorney's fees? Or is your position that they did the right thing by tagging that on to the award, asking for confirmation and judgment to enter, and that they were right to proceed and ask for those costs and fees? How does it work? Does it typically revert back and you always have a second arbitration, or does the court take that on?
Well, thank you. This is your question is what should they have done, and that was similar to Justice Gableman's question. What should they have done? We know what they should not have done, which is plead.
That's not what I want to know. Because I get your argument, but I want to know
the key thing that they should not have continued is to continue the litigation. So once you know there's a dispute, the agreement of the parties is to submit that dispute to arbitration, and you have 180 days to do so.
So now, the matter should have never gone further in the circuit court. You should have demanded a $5,000 judgment. That's it. You don't do anything more to ask the court for fees or costs or anything. And every single time, you go back and you file an attorney's fees claim in arbitration. So it's a two-step process.
Yes. And in the
Did your client make that assertion at all? You know, trial court judge, your job is done here. You're done. If they want fees, this is the subject of arbitration.
We made the point that the fees was a determination that should have been submitted to arbitration.
When did the court enter its final order? So that, you know, judgment actually entered and the confirmation part was done.
The confirmation, all issues have been finally decided in March of 2011, except for the attorney's fees dispute.
Okay, so there was a final order.
No, there was not.
Yes.
There was.
Can you direct me to that in the record?
There was a final order.
No, there's a final order eventually, yes. I'm sorry. The judge rendered an order confirming the award, extending it to joint and several liability as requested, disposing of all issues except for the attorney's fees question. And the transcript of that.
Did the court think it still had something pending before it, or did you all say, okay, this case is complete, we're done?
Well, the court initially denied the, then the court took up the attorney's fees question.
What date was that?
March.
Excuse me. I think the order is December 5th, 2011.
Which order?
So we don't keep talking about it. The final order. That's the only written order that I could find. The
correct.
Final order disposing of all the issues.
Correct. On March 8th, the trial court issued its decision ruling on all issues with the exception of the attorney's fees.
It scheduled a hearing on that.
Scheduled a hearing. There was a March 14th hearing.
Well, before that, March 10, your client filed a letter arguing he's not liable for costs and attorney's fees.
Correct.
In that letter, did he say, Judge, you know, your jurisdiction is done here. This goes back to the arbitration.
The letter doesn't say anything about jurisdiction other than it says that the attorney's fees claim is properly a matter for the arbitrator.
Counselor, I want to shift you over to something we haven't talked a lot about, but what seems to me to be where we should be looking. Section 47 of the manual that you all rely on once you become a member of the Realtors, 47 sets manner of invoking arbitration. And it's in that provision that there is a 180-day rule that you're talking about. But there are also times when that rule of 180 days is suspended. Okay? Now, was it suspended here? Well, that would have to be something, I guess, the arbitration panel might have to decide. But it seems that when a grievance, when a request for arbitration is invoked under Section 47C, then it's referred, it's referred to the grievance committee. And the grievance committee has a given number of days to decide whether the matter is subject to arbitration. And if it does so, then it refers the matter back for arbitration, and a hearing is set under sub C. So there are times when this 180 days that you're talking about is not mathematically determined from when might one might know there's a dispute, because there are times when that running of those days is suspended. Is Section 47 the section of the arbitration agreement that governs this 180-day provision that you're relying on?
No.
Okay. What is the section of the arbitration agreement that you are relying on for 180 days then?
What the trial court was presented with as the arbitration agreement. And again, it's their petitioner's responsibility to prove that there even was an agreement.
Okay. Now, just stop just a minute.
Okay.
You know, you use the term arbitration agreement. I want to be sure we are defining it the same way.
Right.
I define arbitration agreement as the manual that you agree to follow when you become a, quote, realtor. And it is that manual, Section 47, that I just referred you to. Are you talking about a different document than that to which I just referred as the arbitration agreement?
Let me attempt to answer this. In order to proceed with the case, there has to be an arbitration agreement.
You bet.
The parties both agree that there was an agreement.
Right.
Exactly which documents make up that agreement, there is some dispute about. But here's what the trial court said is included, is the Article 17 of that Code of Ethics and Arbitration Manual.
Okay, it's the same manual I've been reading out of.
Yes.
Right?
Article 17.
Okay.
The intake form, as counsel has called it, but what's termed to be the agreement, request an agreement to arbitrate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Article 17, and then an appendix to that manual, which I think is Appendix 5.
Well, is that the trial court's job if all they're supposed to do is confirm the award and send it back for a fee determination? Should the trial court judge be in the business of doing that? You're losing me sometimes because you seem to be
going
back and forth on your theory.
No, it's not a difference of the theory. There's two different cases and two distinctly different jobs. The job that we're here talking about today is strictly under Statute 788.03. In that case, the trial court has to find an agreement to arbitrate, a written agreement to arbitrate. Under the plain reading of the statute, without any need for persuasive authority, it says the trial court has to find
I guess I thought you agreed that there was an agreement to arbitrate. You just thought it was outside of the 180.
Right, but my point is that the trial court needs to find that agreement and then examine the agreement and determine has there been a default of it. That's what the statute says. So the reason why we're here today is that the trial court examined the agreement, said the agreement requires the petitioner to bring his claim within 180 days. It didn't do that. There was no arbitrable dispute any longer because The petitioner didn't bring a timely claim.
Counselor, I have to interrupt you. I'm sorry. I still think you're using arbitration agreement in a variety of ways, and you seem to say so did the trial court. The trial court used chapter or section 17 out of the arbitration manual. But when I refer you to section 47, I hear you saying to me, that's not part of the arbitration agreement. Am I hearing you right or wrong?
I'm taking the law of the case, which is what the trial court found to be the arbitration agreement.
Okay, but I'm an appellate court here, and you know what? Unless it's a finding of fact, I don't have to worry about what the trial court did. I have to interpret the law, and I've got a written document that's been provided to us and is part of the record. And my question to you is Section 47 of the manual part of the arbitration agreement to which Synergy agreed by becoming a member of Realtor? You can just say yes or no.
I'd have to confirm if that was actually part of the record presented to the trial court. If not, no. Because for purposes of this case, the court's analysis is what was that agreement?
My question to you is not the answer that you're not answering the question I'm asking. My question to you is only, is Section 47 part of the arbitration agreement to which Synergy agreed when they became a member of Realtors? It doesn't have to do with any particular dispute.
I'm uncertain whether that's accurate to say that was part of the agreement.
Okay. Thank you.
That was your response twice now. That is, you don't know if it's part of the agreement. That's perfectly all right, but I just want to clarify. Twice you have answered that question. You answered it the same way. Right.
My answer is this. If the agreement that was presented to the court for it to analyze under Section 788.03 is the agreement we're talking about, I don't know whether that article was part of what was presented at that time or not. It cannot be added after the fact is my position.
It's not part of the appendix of the plaintiff, petitioner, appellant, petitioners, and it's not part of your supplemental appendix.
It's part of the record.
I couldn't find it.
It's part of the record sheet. It's the appendix to the amicus curiae.
Mm-hmm. Could I ask us, the original arbitration that both sides agreed to, there are no attorney fees involved in that original arbitration. Is that right?
In the award?
Yeah.
The board did not award any attorney's fees.
But, I mean, is there any normal attorney fees when parties go to arbitration?
Well, when both parties are both licensed attorneys as well as parties in the arbitration, generally they don't. You're not allowed to collect attorney's fees, of course.
Oh, okay. That's what I
assume. Which is the heart of the dispute.
So I thought I understood your answer to an earlier question that the attorney fees don't, a right to attorney fees don't arise until there's a confirmation proceeding. Is that right?
If there were one, yes. If there were such a right, correct.
Exactly. Okay. So why does the right to attorney fees, if any, related to confirmation, why is that bound by the original 180 days?
Justice, it's a new... The 180 days begins when the dispute is known. It's a different dispute. In other words, had counsel said the case was resolved for all... When the court entered an order in March, and you asked earlier about what the date was... So the court resolved all questions that were raised in the claim, except for the attorney's fees. And that was on March 14th. There was a decision and order dated March 16th. The trial court denied the request for attorney's fees, right? It was known at that time that there was a dispute, and had they wanted, they could have, first of all, demanded, hey, pay us some amount, which they didn't do. They could have said, okay, we're going to request that we arbitrate this dispute now, which they could have done, which is what the payday loan case says they should have done. But they didn't. They moved for reconsideration. They kept putting it before the trial court. They continued to litigate it. They continued that throughout the period for the next 9 months until they finally were denied again. And that only then, and even then they didn't do anything for another, 7 months, 8 months. And then they said, oh, we want you to appear. I mean, it would be no different if they came forward 20 years later and said, oh, you've got to come to an arbitration proceeding from something that happened 20 years ago.
So your position is that your view of the 180 days, the first day is, March 15th? Or
March 10th, they knew that there was a dispute.
March 10th. That's day one?
Yes. But the way I look at this is actually in reverse. The 180 days you can look at from this point of view. When you look at the request and agreement to arbitrate, which they filed with the association, it says must be filed within 180 days. In other words, any claim that's older than 180 days from whenever that thing is filed, the arbitration agreement is not applicable. Under its own terms, having nothing to do with the rules, which also reiterate this 180-day period, but simply on the point of the agreement to arbitrate, it says it only applies retroactive 180 days, looking back 180 days. Claims older than that can't be brought in this process because they've expired. So there's this question about whether this is a substantive rule or a procedural rule. Is a false question. It's both. It's procedural. Throughout the manual, it's stated several times that there's a 180-day process. They have to file the certain form. It has to be done within 180 days. But the actual agreement entered into by the parties also says they'll arbitrate claims, only the claims that have occurred within the past 180 days. They filed that over a year after they knew there was a claim.
But, Counselor, isn't it procedural because it is really forum specific? It is the arbitration manual that sets 180 days, not a court not a state statute or an administrative rule. It's the agreement that the parties entered into by becoming a member of Realtors. And as I tried to point out earlier, there are times when those days are not counted. They're stayed. And it's, you know, I don't know how that would work out in this case. I mean, maybe if the arbitration panel got this, they'd say, you're right. They waited too long, and they can't file this. I don't know the answer to that, but I can see it's not a simple count up the days mathematically. I just don't see, how you get out of the fact that the rule is established by the, quote, Realtors, you know, arbitration manual. It's not a court rule, so why should the court decide this?
I don't disagree that it's one of their rules, but my point is it's also a contractual term. There has to be a contract or we're not sitting here today. So what is the contract? And the contract includes that term. That is something that the court must address, is what are the terms of this agreement? In order to decide has there been a violation or a default under the agreement, the court has to first say what is the agreement, has to look at the terms of the agreement, and then say, has there been a default? Otherwise, the statute is clear. You reject the petition.
Right, but the statute doesn't talk about what days you count to get up to 180. I mean, it's not a mathematical thing, according to the manual. There are times when, as they call it, suspension of filing deadlines. So, you know, I mean, I just don't see... I guess I've said what my problem is.
Well, I see my time is up. I apologize if I wasn't able to address your question.
Yeah, that's okay. You did a good job of trying. Thank you.
I have
Justice Brasser.
The court made a decision on March 10th or March 14th, whatever it was, but it didn't decide attorney fees. You want to say that the first day of the 180 days was either March 10th or March 14th. court was going to consider the attorney fees issue after that. Are you saying that the other side had a duty to file a request for arbitration before the court decided the case on attorney fees?
Well, first, I'm saying they shouldn't have brought it in that litigation in the first place. But assuming that they decided to do that, and that was mistake number one, but if they did that and they now realize that they shouldn't have, they should have followed the procedure. I mean, yes, they should have requested arbitration, and if it was refused, the payday loan case says what's supposed to happen is the trial court stays its proceedings, waits for the arbitration, then the arbitration gets completed, and then that gets wrapped into the trial court proceedings. That's what's supposed to happen under the payday loan case. It would make sense. It's more efficient judicially. Rather than litigating it for the next 9 months and then coming back and bringing the same claim again, which is, I mean, we haven't even addressed the merits whatsoever, but what should have happened is, if there were a refusal at that point, is to request that the court compel arbitration in the pending action. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mormond. Mr. Mormond, before you begin, I'm having a little trouble understanding your appendix. On Appendix 84, I'll start a little earlier. It's appendix number 7, which deals with the code. And it goes.
Article 17.
Yeah.
If the page numbering is wrong, it looks like part of the page numbering in the table of contents was incorrect, and I apologize.
Yes, and that's what I'm driving at in part. And then 85 goes to, Appendix 85 goes to 46. And then there's a blank page, 86. And then 87 has something else. And in 87, we've got Article 17, but it's not under that code, is it? It's Article 17 is under standard of practice. Is that right?
Article 17 is a freestanding article of the Realtor Code of Ethics. It is reprinted in the arbitration manual, and therefore we'll show a copy from that. But it's actually in existence way before the manual ever existed.
That's what I'm trying to do. Yeah. And when you read the explanatory note, it would seem to indicate that the standards of practice, which is 17, serve to clarify the ethical obligations imposed, and that's why you put it there. And then 89 is blank, and then you go back, then you got a lot of other things, agreement, et cetera. And then on page, 98, you go back to the Code of Ethics and Arbitration. And that's where Section 47 is.
Partly that the reason they're cut up is because they were used to show different things, and I'm submitting what the respondent submitted as well. When this last 97 was sent in, for instance, to say that the arbitration manual provides rules for the procedures for the proceedings of ethics and arbitration for the counsel, which at one point or another he had denied or somehow misconstrued or tried to confusingly describe, and this was put in there to prove his own submissions proved otherwise.
Are the full documents in the record here?
Well, not the full arbitration manual. It's 300 pages, but.
Okay, then it's your excerpts that are in the record or somebody's excerpts.
Didn't the amicus provide a very complete, they show Article 17 as part of the Code of Ethics and Arbitration Manual, and they also show Section 47 that I referred to with the same italicized printing showing it comes out of the same book, Code of Ethics and Arbitration.
And it's reprinted in there. In other words, they are separate. If I might really quickly try to do this, the arbitration agreement is by membership, and our argument would be it's under Article 17. The manual after that point creates rules that apply to all realtors. The intake form is not the arbitration agreement, although at whatever time convenient, the respondent has referred to it that way. Because there's no agreement to arbitrate this case that both people signed. Both people here were realtors, and their obligation arises through that membership.
Mm-hmm.
The separate agreement contains a promise, And then that, well, first, the res judicata argument should be just thrown away. Every time the respondent refers to a claim in the prior case as being previously litigated, it is inaccurate. What happened actually is we sent in that because he refused to pay, we had to submit a confirmation and proceeded to get confirmation and enforcement, which the promise said they would pay for, or reimburse for. In that action, Judge Albert went on vacation, issued a confirmation in a non-final order right away, and then, but the way attorney's fee, then left the attorney's fees angle there, the way that came up is actually we put a wherefore clause that included standard attorney's fees as a court may. The respondent wrote and said, that's frivolous. He wrote that to the court. It shouldn't even be before this court now or this proceeding, but that's what he did. And then, so we let that go the first time. He said it again. Finally said, no, it's not. Not only is it not frivolous, the law provides that we should be able to do this. And the article was not our entitlement to attorney's fees. He promised to reimburse by having caused another realtor to have to go to court and incur expenses and to get paid. That he agreed to reimburse because his failure to comply caused those expenses. That's entitlement to those things. What was before the first court, before Judge Albert, not this case, was whether the court had authority in the context of a 78810 proceeding to award fees. And in the end, the judge said, no, I don't. But he cited sympathetically Judge Dykeman's opinion and said the court really should. But if we had been reimbursed in that action, then it would satisfy or set off any reimbursement that we'd otherwise want to seek under the promise that was later breached. But we didn't. So what we have is a promise that required a filing for arbitration. As to the timing, the respondent told the other court, said, no, the date should be September, cherry-picking dates just at random, all premised on the idea that their prior claim had been litigated twice, which was never the case and was explicitly rejected by the circuit court here and never appealed. Now he says it should be dated from March 10, but the key to all of those, to throw those out, is he never paid. And when he finally tried to pay at the end, that's required a final order from December 5th, is because he tried to tag positions on it, conditions, that it would wipe out the attorney's fee claim, et cetera. Finally, Judge Albert, in the prior decisions, said this is the final order. It doesn't reach anything else, only confirmation. And I should say one more thing about the attorney. The 180 days is not a statute of limitations. It is a rule of the association, and it's written in a way to be the later of events. And completely unrefuted is what I wrote in there, that would have been impossible, and he didn't suggest it at the time, that we actually break off that action and file an action. One can imagine the argument he would come up with here. They hadn't even completed that. They didn't have a complaint. They don't have a figure, and they submitted anyhow. It would have been impossible at that point, but also contrary to the purpose. The promise that the respondent breached in this case said, if I don't comply with my association rules, I will compensate you for the cost of confirmation and enforcement. Enforcement means getting paid, making us whole. None of that occurred till later. And none of that occurred until at the end. That is what we're seeking, is that separate. As about arbitration, the arbitrators do not award fees. Fees came up, the realtor system doesn't do that. Fees came up as a result of the promise. If I don't comply and it costs you fees and costs, I will reimburse those. That's where that came up. But I hope I have answered.
Thank you. Anything else, counsel?
I could keep going, but
Justice Prosser.
I have one question. Were you ever an auctioneer?
I'm sorry?
Were you ever an auctioneer?
Oh, I'm surprised I could spit that much out getting this. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mormond, and thank you, Mr. Graham. Where are your arguments today on an arbitration matter? We've had these issues of arbitrability before, but not for a while. And this concludes our hearing on 2013 AP 1205, First Weber Group versus Synergy Real Estate Group. And the court is in recess until 1:30, when we'll hear our third case today. We're in recess.